This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Morgan Marion.
And I'm Simon Connolly.
We're back with the second half of Simon's chat with Dr. Umart Somji. This time, we'll be hearing about how the weevils can actually build and maintain these crazy weapons.
In the New Zealand giraffe weevil, males have this elongated head that they use in jousting-like competition for mating opportunities. And just like other species that use exaggerated structures in competition, they scale hypermetrically with body size. So what does that mean? That means that large individuals invest disproportionately more in the structures compared to small ones. So a small individual in its body shape is not simply a scaled up version or a scaled down version of a big one. And they differ in the proportion of body size of different parts. And because the difference between a small individual giraffe weevil and a large one is so big, the difference in their weapons is even larger because of this positive allometry.
When you're talking about animals that use exaggerated traits to fight each other, what would be some that people are very familiar with?
We know that rhinos use their horns in competition for mating opportunities, but we also know that rhinoceros beetles use horns in competition for mating opportunities. We know that elk use their antlers in fights for competition, in competition for mating opportunities. But we also know that there's these tiny antlered flies where males have antlers and they fight in very similar ways to elk, and they lock horns in competition for mating opportunities. Elephants have these huge tusks that they use in competition, but they're these tiny miniature weevils that have these tusks that they use also in competition. We know that many birds have ornamented plumage that they use in sexual selection, and some canopy-dwelling mosquitoes have these feather-like ornaments that males use in displays to attract females in competition for reproductive opportunities. So we find that many of these exaggerated structures are found not only in the vertebrates, but are extremely common in invertebrates. And there's some fascinating patterns that we find in these structures, no matter what group that we see them in. And one of these patterns that is really fascinating to me is this pattern of positive allometry. It happens in rhinoceros horns, but it also happens in rhinoceros beetle horns. It happens in elk antlers, but it also happens in antlered flies' antlers. It happens in elephant tusks and weevil tusks. And so the fact that it's such a broad pattern that we see again and again in these different groups of organisms suggests that there is some similarities that allow the structure to form in similar ways. And to me, I find that extremely fascinating.
So this positive allometry, it's a concept that is unified across species that have absolutely no relation to each other whatsoever, but it's always found when males are competing for the opportunities to mate with females.
Exactly. Well, it's not always found in all species, but it's found in really broad groups, and it's very often found in males that are competing for mating opportunities with females. We often don't see other types of weapons like the canines of big cats or the defensive structures of echidnas or porcupines exhibiting this type of scaling pattern. We often find the scaling pattern used in within species competition and most often in competition for mating opportunities.
And when you say positive allometry, that's the scaling relationship you were referring to, right? Where as a male gets bigger, he invests even more into the size of his weapon.
Exactly. One example that I find really interesting is in the cervids or the deer species. One of the smallest cervid species we know is a pudu, which is about 10 kilos, about the size of a medium dog. And it has these tiny pointed antlers that account for 0.1% of its body mass. While one of the largest species of deer we know to have ever existed is the enormous Irish elk that had these massive flaring antlers, more than 3.5 meters across, that accounted for almost 10% of its body mass. So relative to its body size, an Irish elk is dedicating almost 100 times more into antlers than a pudu is. And that is a fascinating example of this positive allometry or hypermetric scaling of these sexually selected weapons.
So what relationship that you're talking about is that's playing across again across multiple species between these pudu and these now extinct elk. But within giraffe weevils, given that extreme size dimorphism you were talking about before, you see that difference across in a single species. In fact, even on a single log.
Exactly. So one really hard question that we've been trying to answer in this field is trying to understand why is it that large individuals can invest so much more than small individuals? Unfortunately, in most species, individuals don't differ within species, don't differ very much in body size. So often we find about a 2 or 3-fold difference in size among adults of the same species. If we really wanted to test this idea in cervids, for example, about maybe large individuals get some energetic benefits from investing in these large structures or have other physiological adaptations that allow them to invest in these large structures, it would be hard to test because the elk and the pudu live in different environments. They face different pressures and ecological selection occurs differently in them. They feed on different things. So it's really hard to test those ideas. If we really wanted to test that idea, it'd be great if we got a pudu to grow to the size of an Irish elk. Well, we just can't do that. But we found that in the weevils. If the smallest weevil was the size of a pudu, the biggest weevil would be the size approximately of a modern elk. So we can look at the size variation within a single species that we could only look at before across species. And so that's why I think they're such excellent models for testing some of these hypotheses about why large individuals invest disproportionately more in these traits compared to small ones.
And that's the questions that you're trying to get at with watching females mate with females while they're drilling and then harvesting their eggs. Is that correct?
Exactly. That's one of the aspects, exactly. Because there's such a huge range in body size in individuals in the population, there's got to be some reproductive success that's garnered by these small males. But the question is, how are they doing it? And what maintains this huge variation in body size in these individuals in a population? And why don't we see that variation in other species? What is it about the giraffe weevil that maintains this crazy range in body size? We don't know. And by looking into the behavior, by looking into the biology, and by figuring out paternity, we hope to be closer to answering some of these questions.
This is where I really regret not doing a video medium, because the glee on your face is just excellent. Talk me through, if you can, just how ridiculous these big giraffe weevil males are. Because the smaller ones, with the exception of the kind of female drill piece on the end, the smaller males look a lot like the females in terms of their body plan. But that's not really true of the big males. How would you describe them?
So these giraffe weevils are just fascinating if you just take a little bit of time to look at their body plan. There's an abdomen that's about half of their body length, and then they have their thorax, which is maybe less than a fifth of their body length, and then they have their head, which in the largest males accounts for almost half of their body length. And so if you think about these three parts of their body and how larger males invest in disproportionately larger traits compared to small ones, you can imagine that a small male, and they have these really, really cute bulging eyes. They stick out from the head, they're very spherical and they're black and they reflect the light. And you just go look online and find a picture of a New Zealand giraffe weevil and just look at their eyes. They're adorable. Especially for you know, insects have these external skeletons. They don't have facial expressions. But if there was any insect that I could put facial expressions onto, it would, you know, project facial expressions onto it. It would be a weevil. But then these large males, their head just keeps on going. So if you look at it, you expect it to stop soon, but it just keeps on going. And eventually it ends with these mandibles and then these extremely long antennae that go out on either side of those mandibles. And so they're extremely bizarre looking, and underneath their head, they have all these hairs, which is one of the reasons they're named barbicornis. They have this hairy head. And so it looks like just a really, really long beard underneath their head.
So these huge males, these up to 9 centimeter ones, their back half is their legs and their abdomen and everything that they need to get around, but their entire front half is just this massive head that they're carrying around with them.
Exactly. And one of the things we figured out was, how is it that these large males are able to carry around this disproportionately larger structure? One thing we found was that head scales with positive allometry. And this is stuff that Chrissy had figured out before too, but the legs also scale with positive allometry, likely to support that elongated head. But the antenna also scale with positive allometry in those males. So disproportionately large individuals not only carry disproportionately large heads, but also legs and antenna. And so there's a lot of other parts of their body that are modified, likely because of that modification of that large head.
So they're all, these big males are kind of built around the idea of a big head, and then everything else just kind of has to get bigger to make it work.
It's so strange. It's almost like, it's like a giant walking head is what it looks like.
So given the size of these males and that half of their entire body is this big long head, is that a difficult structure for them to use and maintain?
That's a really good question. And that was a question that inspired my earlier work on the giraffe weevil with Chrissy painting. One big question generally with these structures is, how is it that large males are able to maintain the presumed heightened energetic cost of all that extra tissue in the head? Because all that extra tissue likely means more muscles, more nerve fibers, more sensory investment. And if large males are investing more in those extremely energetically costly structures, then they should be paying higher energetic costs for those structures. And one of the things that we did was we put weevils in little airtight syringes, and we put a little oxygen sensor in the syringe, and we measured their rate of oxygen consumption. And this was a proxy for their metabolic rate. And we found out that these weevils have metabolic rates that are in line with other insects of their size. But we also found that large individuals have a lower resting metabolic rate per gram of tissue compared to small individuals. And this is also in line with metabolic theory. Large individuals in many species have lower per gram resting metabolic rates compared to small individuals. And so, you know, that was interesting to figure out, but it almost leads to the additional question, if larger males are paying a lower cost per gram of tissue for their body, how is it that they can afford to have this disproportionately large weapon? It's a little bit of a paradox. But when we looked into the structure of the weapon, we found out that even though this weapon is so much larger than the males, most of that structure is cuticle. It's not nerves and muscles and tendons like we thought. Most of that additional mass and size is this less metabolically active tissue. So males are able to have this disproportionately larger head at a lower metabolic maintenance cost than we had initially assumed. So in some ways, that's how we resolve the paradox, that they were able to have these cheap structures. There was an economy of size. And that might be a general principle that we find in other species. And that's one thing that studying this one model organism can allow us to look for in other organisms that have this type of exaggeration.
When you say cuticle, that's the kind of material that weevils and other insects build their exoskeleton out of.
Exactly. Yes. So the cuticle is the exterior skeleton of an insect. It's an extremely complicated structure. It's composed of multiple layers, including layers that prevent water loss, layers that protect the insect, layers that are sites of muscle attachment. It generally contains the body of the insect. And so they're extremely intricate and complex structures, but a large part of the structure, just like human bone or mammal bone is composed of metabolically inactive tissue, and it's relatively light and strong for its size. And so it turns out to be an extremely efficient structure to make weapons out of.
And so you say this is a rule that carries across a lot of animals. So that would be constructed in the same way that, like, the examples you mentioned before, like elk antlers and rhino horns are constructed. They've got, they're out from these cheap tissues. They're very similar to fingernail tissue, kind of in a way. They're a lot, very cheap to make weapons out of and very energetically low cost.
Exactly. So by studying these weevils, we recognize that most of the exaggeration was happening in metabolically inexpensive cuticle. And when we start looking more broadly at other animals, we notice that elephants make their tusks of metabolically inactive dentine, and rhinos make their horns of metabolically inactive keratin, the same stuff that we make our fingernails out of. And elk, cervids, and giraffoids make their antlers from metabolically inert bony tissue. And birds make their feathers from metabolically inert keratin. So many of these traits that are extremely exaggerated and have perplexed scientists for a long time in terms of how can these animals bear the energetic cost of these structures are actually composed of structures that are not extremely energetically costly to maintain directly, at least. Of course, there are costs of carrying those structures around. There are costs that are imposed because of making those animals perhaps more likely to get predated on. But in terms of their maintenance costs, they seem to have found a way to make them big without making them expensive.
But with the giraffe weevil weaponry, you say that's an extension of their head, and at the end they have their antennae and their mouth parts. So it can't just be an energetically, essentially dead tissue all the way through. How are they supplying oxygen and whatever else they need to the far end of it?
The way that giraffe weevils, their body plan is designed is so bizarre. We don't even have a general idea of how they're supplying that metabolically active nerve tissue, for example, that's common in insect antenna. We know that insects supply most of their body tissues with oxygen through a network of tubules called trachea, and external air enters through the trachea. It's usually passive diffusion, but now more and more studies are showing there's some active pumping involved in helping the airflow through the body of the insect. But because in these large weevils, those spiracles, those openings to the external air, are so far away from the tip of the mandibles where the antenna are, we don't know what the structure of the respiratory pathways are, and we don't know how they scale. And I mean, it's just a huge distance for passive diffusion to occur. So that's an open question.
So when you talk about this trachea and passive diffusion, what is actually the substance that is moving through these trachea? Is it some kind of blood like we would understand it inside our own bodies, or is it something different?
The way that insects supply their tissues with oxygen, a lot of the supply is done through tubules that connect directly to the outside air through these openings called spiracles. And there's this network of tubules that run throughout the insect body that supply different tissues with oxygen. So unlike us, where most of our oxygen is supplied through our blood, most of the insect's oxygen is supplied through this tracheal network, where there's direct diffusion of oxygen from these tracheals directly to the tissues. And because there's this direct diffusion, the deeper the tracheals are, or the tissues are, in the body of the insect, the stronger the diffusion gradient, and the harder it is for carbon dioxide to diffuse out and for oxygen to diffuse in. Many insects have developed mechanisms to increase diffusion processes, like pumping air or contractions of the abdomen that then help them pull air into these structures. But we're just starting to understand the respiratory structures in insects and how they supply the tissues with oxygen. The New Zealand giraffe weevil is fascinating because its body pattern is so strange and those antennae are so far away from the closest openings, the closest spiracles. We don't know how they supply oxygen to those really, really far away structures.
And what methods are you using to try and answer that question?
One of the things we're doing is we're taking these weevils and we're doing these extremely detailed x-ray scans. So these x-ray scans are occurring at a resolution of about 3.5 microns. Just for scale, the width of a human hair is on average 70 microns. So we're getting extremely good resolution in the internal structure of these weevils. And we have calibrated the x-ray, these x-rays, to be able to distinguish air within the body of the insect. And we hope this air is a good indicator of where these tracheal structures are. Of course, there's going to be some air in the alimentary canal of the insect and in different parts, but we are getting networks of these tubules as they run through the insect's body. And we are starting to get a picture of how these networks run through the head of the insect to supply those antennae with oxygen. So I'm really excited about using these scans to understand the tracheal networks throughout the body plan of this really bizarre insect.
So when you say a scan, what's the kind of product that you end up with from that scan?
We end up with a 3D image of the weevil, but it's not just a single image. It's composed of thousands of images because we can look into individual slices throughout the insect and see how different tissues are composed at different parts of the insect. So we could look, for example, into the head and do a cross-section of the head and see what proportion of the head is accounted for by these tracheoles, by tendons, by cuticle, or by other tissues. So we can start to get an idea of the structure of the weevil in this really detailed sense.
And that will give you information that not only about that weevil, but that you can apply to a lot of other insects that whose, like you say, their respiration and how they supply oxygen around their bodies is still rather mysterious.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons I think these sexually selected traits, so these highly exaggerated traits, are really interesting and can be really informative, is because sexual selection pushes structures to their physiological limits. We often see extremely expensive behaviors, energetically costly mating behaviors or dances in birds, for example, or really, really extreme morphology in arthropods. And because it pushes physiology to these extremes, it provides an avenue for us to test how animals are physiologically dealing with the challenges of having these exaggerated structures, of having these energetically costly structures in some cases, or how they found avenues not to pay the full cost of those structures as we might think.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't? Any cool little details from your work that our listeners might want to hear?
One other really interesting group of insects that I study are these leaf-footed bugs. So the family is Coridae. It's a family of bugs where many species have evolved these really interesting looking legs, hind legs. Males often use these legs as weapons in competition for mating opportunities. They have swollen femurs that are packed full of muscle, spines often on these femurs and on their tibias that they use to fight with other individuals for mating opportunities. Sometimes they make holes in each other's wings when they fight. So it's a really fascinating system. And I'm really excited about them because, you know, just by studying the giraffe weevil and by studying these insects, I started to realize that so much of what we know in biology today came from people who invested a huge amount of time and resources into uncovering the natural history of those insects or those organisms without necessarily knowing what they would figure out. Christian is an example of a person that did that and is the reason I'm here studying these weevils and is the reason why we're able to ask these questions that are much more general and that allow us to look at other animals in different ways. So these bugs are another example where historically they just weren't very well studied, especially in terms of their behavior and morphology. But now we're getting a better idea of how they use these structures, how costly those structures are, and how they deal with them. And it's giving us a different perspective on how these traits evolve, how they change, and what selection pressures act on them. But it also makes me recognize that there are thousands of different species of insects that are present in the world that have really bizarre, curious, fascinating behaviors, and we know so little about them. They're repositories of mystery, and it makes me really excited to know that they're out there. So I always want to end with a kind of a plug for insects to watch them, try to understand what's going on, realize that in many cases, something that you observe may not be something that is well known. And that's the beauty of studying insects. There's so much that is open to discovery in this group. And so that makes me really excited about the potential for discovery in the world of insects.
Dr. Umat Somji, thank you so, so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for listening to this interview with the amazing Umat Somji. In our next episode, we'll be doing something a little different, as Simon and I get together to talk about Bug of the Year 2024. We'll be talking hot contenders, strong underdogs, and the hot gossip on all 20 candidates. You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Marion. You can find us at Science Bug Pod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by Free FM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. Catch you next time!
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.